What's wrong with nationalism? Today on The Curious Task, I speak with Alex Narasta. Welcome to The Curious Task from the Institute for Liberal Studies, where we explore economics, politics, philosophy, and other ideas from a classical liberal perspective. I'm Alex Aragona, your host, and today I'm speaking with Alex Narasta. Alex is the Vice President for Economic and Social Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. He has authored many articles and also has some books. One of his primary areas of focus and interest is immigration policy. Now, a recent essay in National Affairs with his co-author, Ilya Soman, will be the basis of our conversation today. It's titled The Case Against Nationalism. Alex, welcome back to The Curious Task.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great. So Alex, as you know, we base each episode on a question and theme and go over the answers and conversation takes us. Our question today is, what's wrong with nationalism? And pretty much all of our conversation today is going to be based on the essay that you co-authored with Ilya Soman, The Case Against Nationalism. And let's start with some context right off the bat. So let's talk about nationalism in and of itself first, and then we can move on to the effects and so on and so forth as our conversation goes. So one thing I like that you did in your essay is that you trace what some proponents of nationalism feel like nationalism is or want it to be. And then you get into ultimately what it practically means in the real world and yours and Ilya's thoughts on it and so on and so forth. So what I like to do first here is sort of give that sort of definition or context for what nationalism is defined as by its proponents that you've discovered. Then we can get into the other stuff. So what is nationalism purported to be?
So looking at the major proponents today, folks like Yoram Hazony and Rich Lowry, I'm excluding politicians because they never define their terms. But, you know, looking at the intellectuals, Rich and Yoram basically say that, you know, nationalism is an ideology that supports culture in a particular country. It's the idea that the nation, which is separate from the government, should govern that country. That this historically has developed by the combination of different tribes with different backgrounds coming together for cultural cohesive reasons, and that nationalism produces better outcomes. If every sort of nation is culturally homogeneous, if it's this sort of same group, then you get more cooperation, better outcomes, and somehow all the problems of political economy and normal disagreements that people have sort of fade away, or at least are greatly diminished because of this homogeneity. Now, what I think is wrong with that is it bears no resemblance to how nationalism actually works in the real world or what it actually means. And this was something that was revealing to me. I'm an American. When I hear the term nation, I've always thought it was just a synonym for country. So when I heard people say the term like nation state, I just thought it was like oddly redundant. Like, why would you say like nation state? Like, they mean, you know, roughly the same things. But it turns out when you talk to Europeans, when you talk to people in other countries around the world, and I do think Canada is a lot more like the US in this regard, like when we talk about nations, you know, our terminology is similar. But when you talk to people around the world, nation means something different. And it really goes back to like the Latin root of the word, natio, which means race of people or tribe. And in the real world, when we view nationalism, it is an ideology of basically ethnic politics. It's the idea that every ethnic group should have a government that represents that group. And if it's a country with minorities, there should be one group that's dominant over the other group. And that is what we see when we take a look at surveys of self-described nationalists in the real world. That's what we see when we see self-described nationalist parties around the world. So in practice, nationalism is basically like a primitive, statist, protectionist, largely anti-capitalist, xenophobic, often ethnocentric, basically like proto-ideology of my tribe best, your tribe bad, with the tribe being at the core of this ideology and a tribe being largely an ethnic group. Now, what's interesting is the proponents of nationalism, you know, Yoram and Rich, who I mentioned earlier, they spend a lot of time trying to distinguish their ideology from patriotism. Mm-hmm. And I do think they're different. But the way that they describe it it's basically patriotism because of the audience I think they're trying to appeal to. Because if you describe nationalism in the way that Europeans understand it, it would have like zero appeal to almost all Americans and Canadians and other people, because it's just, you can't really have like an ethnic identity in the United States. It's kind of absurd, or in Canada for that matter, because it's kind of like crazy. Like it would never work. So that's the basic definition of this term and where, and how I come at it.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, just to push forward the patriotism, nationalism, distinction, so it sounds like you think that is actually a valid distinction then, like not in terms of the way they might do it, but I'm just talking about your thoughts right now, like or the kind of thing that was coming across in your essay. I understood that you're saying, okay, nationalism one thing and patriotism is another thing. I just wanted to know if you can go a little bit more into that.
Yeah, they are definitely different things. I mean, I see patriotism as people liking their country, like when they're from, kind of proud of the institutions, proud of the culture and this and that. And that's all great. Like, I think almost everybody feels like that. But it's a difference in that it's not like a political ideology. It doesn't push for certain, say, economic protectionism or the supremacy of one domestic group over another group. It's not bound up in ethnicity, you know, whereas nationalism is. The way I think about it is like patriotism is to love what nationalism is a stalking, you know, and they have some, you know, there's some overlap and some people can be confused, you know, for frequently confused, you know, stalking behavior with love and vice versa. And there's some, maybe some superficial similarities there, but ultimately they are very different in their outcomes. They're very different in their approaches, and they basically describe like very different emotional responses. So patriotism is great. I love patriotism. I think it's wonderful. I think it's natural. I think the way we feel about it is natural, and it's not harmful in almost all cases. Nationalism, however, unfortunately, is also natural, I argue in this essay and elsewhere, but it's very harmful. It does a lot of bad to the world, does a bad to individual liberty in the issues that we care about. It's bad for free markets. It's bad for peace, domestic tranquility. And to the extent that a lot of modern societies are prosperous and free, it's by reducing the power of nationalism to influence policy in our culture. Like, we can't eradicate it. We shouldn't try. I think it's part of our human nature. But to the extent that we prosper, it's by reducing that negative element of our nature, by reducing its power over our lives and institutions.
Mm-hmm. No, that was a lot of excellent stuff that you just went through there. And there's some great context for some further questions I want to ask you. I think I want to get a little bit further into now, as you were just leading into, sort of the ultimate problems, even though you said nationalism might be, for some people at least, like a little bit of a natural tendency, sort of writ large. You said a couple times that in real life, as it's applied or when it's followed through with, it creates a lot of negative outcomes. And you had mentioned too, and there's a quote in your essay, you say exactly with Ilya, that real world nationalism is a primitive, and then you list some things: statist, protectionist, anti-capitalist, xenophobic, and often ethnocentric proto-ideology, like you were saying, the my tribe's best, your tribe bad type thing. I thought it'd be fun, because your essay later gets into two specific pillars, the democracy angle and the economics angle, but I thought it'd be fun to get into more of your thoughts by actually taking sort of the terms you threw out there and going through them. I mean, for example, on the first part, the statist protectionist part, could you get a little bit more into that? I mean, you're saying when this stuff's applied, when nationalism's done in the real world, you end up with all these negative outcomes. Let's start with statism and protectionism. What do you mean by that?
So it's nationalism, you know, every political ideology has a role for the state. Yeah, even anarchists, right? Their role for the state is that it shouldn't exist. So in sort of the classical liberal or libertarian or traditional conservative view, the state is something that should exist, but we view it with skepticism. We think that it requires numerous institutions to restrain its actions. And what really counts is individual liberty, a flourishing society, allowing people to pursue their own ends and their own goals. And the state would be focused on protecting individual rights and making sure, you know, negative externalities don't overwhelm the system and from foreign invaders. Nationalists, on the other hand, say there is no legitimate restriction on the state, because the state represents and embodies the will of the nation, which is the core ethnic group, and that to restrict the power of the government is actually to restrict the freedom, in a weird way, of people in this society to determine the role of the state. So in a way, they see constitutional limitations and on the power of government as being a limitation on the power of the nation or the freedom of the nation to do what it wants. And this manifests itself in several ways. One of the things that is most troubling is nationalist societies, and every society, I think, has this tendency to try to centralize power in one individual. Mm-hmm. We see that certainly in the U.S. political system, with the presidential system. Other countries certainly see it as well. But the difference is that nationalism makes it a virtue. It basically says, like, a nation is an abstraction. It is an abstraction. We can't all know each other, right? It's not a community. It's all right. A bunch of strangers, even though they may have the same ethnic or cultural background. So what happens is this individual becomes the leader of the nation. It becomes a representative of the nation. It becomes a totem, basically, a measure of what the nation is, and supposedly encapsulates all of its virtues, its manly virtues mainly, of, you know, strength and hard work and industry and toughness and all that good stuff that we want the government, or that they want the government, to have. So as a result of this, any limitation on the power of the state or this individual is actually a limitation on the people in this society. And so it's a very sort of a coherent internal logic that pushes for a very powerful government represented by one person. And that leads to, of course, statism, leads to economic protectionism, because ultimately the only rule that matters is that of the nation and what they decide is best. And ultimately that means we need to protect the nation from outsiders. We need to protect it from foreigners. We need to protect it from trade and the dislocations caused by trade and from immigration and everything else. So it just becomes very natural, this progression, which is why almost everywhere we see it in reality, nationalism is a force that reduces individual liberty. Yeah, you can have exceptions, right? Like I think like Eastern European countries, when they broke away from communism and from the domination of the Soviet Union and a lot of these post-Soviet states, you know, they were going away from a communist society. They were trying to move away from that, trying to move toward more freedom, and nationalism was a very valuable tool in doing that. So it's not always like 100%
right.
Evil in the same sense that I would say communism is basically 100% of the time evil. Right. But almost all the time, nationalism pushes in a direction that reduces human freedom, individual liberty, and economic freedom.
Mm-hmm. And let's branch off from that train of thought that you just laid out there into like the specific discussion in your essay as well, when you guys get further into like this, the nationalism as a threat to democracy, democratic institutions, at least the way we in the West know them, kind of thing. And is that essentially why? Is that basically how we bridge that gap there into that thought that, I mean, if you have a strongman type of political style and you have people trying to sort of symbolically or embody sort of the quote will of the nation, however they get there, right, into some sort of strong man or strong team of people running the country, I mean, is it just the plain and simple fact, you know, succinctly stated that, well, therefore the type of republic ideals or, you know, parliamentary democracy, I mean, in your view, do nationalists think of that, well, if it works, it works, if it doesn't, we move on to something else? The institutions are not good in and of themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the problems with nationalism and why it's such a sort of divisive and schismatic ideology in most places, right? It's sold as an ideology to bring everyone in the nation together, but oftentimes it's schismatic. And that's part of the reason is nationalists think anybody who disagrees with our policies is opposed to the nation. Mm. And if you're opposed to the nation, you're a traitor. You're not a real member of the nation in some important sense of the word. And you're basically betraying the true sense of it. And of course, nationalists know best about what's good for the nation. So this is a very schismatic, and it's very different from most of the concerns that people have in politics, right? Like you can have an economic debate between two political parties where one wants, you know, higher taxes and more welfare, and the other wants lower taxes and less welfare, for instance. And there's no inherent disagreement where like one side is a traitor or betrays the nation and the other. Right. But if you have a nationalist political party on one hand, then all of a sudden the people who disagree with it are traitors. They are undermining the will of the nation. And if the nation nationalist party loses the election, that means, well, there must be some kind of foreign or nefarious or illegal or treasonous activity that explains this. I mean, ultimately, the only reason why the nation fails is not due to any problems of the nation itself, right? The nation is perfect. The nation is right. They know best. So if it fails, it must be because somebody pushed it to fail. There's a conspiracy, right, of globalist elites, you know, whatever evil group you want, or a domestic minority, or traitors within the country who are undermining it for their own, like, parochial reasons, right? It's never because of the failure of the nationalists themselves. So they're very happy to go along with democracy when it rewards them. They are very willing to undermine those institutions when they lose, because ultimately they know best. And it's a very self-righteous ideology in that sense. And it's the ideology of saying, like, we're in this dark forest. We're a tribe banding together. We're surrounded by wolves. And anything that causes division within our tribe will destroy us. Now, ultimately, that means that just means that we have to be in charge. Nationalists have to be in charge. And anybody who disagrees with us wants to destroy the tribe and expose us to being destroyed in the world. Mm-hmm. So it's a very dark, a very depressing, and ultimately an ideology that you know, will take democracy when it leads to the results they want, but is very willing to throw it aside when they don't like the outcome.
Right. And furthering that train of thought, actually, so when we think of, like, modern, let's say specifically Western lowercase l liberal democratic societies today, you were just into very well there, sort of, let's call that the more electoral politics side of things. And it comes to democratic institutions as well. It seems that you and Ilya think that, you know, when it comes to, for instance, the independence of the judiciary, the fact that the Supreme Court does have a role, at least in Canada and the United States, for example, of being the ultimate decider of what's constitutional or not, that kind of thing. It seems like the same logic on the electoral politics side that you just went through applies on the, let's call it, democratic institutions side as well, that, hey, if it rewards the nationalist in terms of what they want to get done, great. If not, there's, you know, whatever, activist judges, a corrupt Supreme Court or whatever. I mean, am I understanding your point of view on that correctly too, that it applies both the electoral side, this nationalist problem, and also the institution side as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, institutions develop, like, for instance, in the United States and Canada, you know, for different historical reasons and at different times, but to try to achieve similar goals. And the goals were, you know, a measure of local rule through states or through provinces, you know, with a delineation of that, but also a way for them to cooperate through a federal structure. And to try to protect individual liberty, free markets, the rights of individuals. And to the extent that these and they do this by limiting the power of governments on various levels so that people can run their own lives. So to the extent that this reduces the power of the nation to make decisions for everybody else, nationalists see it as a hindrance. Now, I also want to be clear, like, other political ideologies see democratic and constitutional government as also being limitations on their power to do things, right? The difference is, I think, and this is a similarity I think it has with communism, right? If you are a communist and you see democratic countries making political and policy decisions that you disagree with and your side loses, well, you say, well, they're betraying the proletariat. They are betraying the working class. They're betraying this, that, and the other stuff and communist and socialist ideology. Nationalists say, no, you're betraying the nation itself. You're betraying this core group of people who are the real Americans or the real Canadians or the real members, and you're betraying them. Whereas other ideologies, you know, liberalism, it's not so much about, like, betrayal. It's about protecting individual liberty and trying to put the state in a certain box where it cannot leave and infringe on individual liberty, right? So sometimes lowercase liberals will say, like, oh, it's a betrayal of our principles. It's a betrayal of this. It's a betrayal of that. But usually it's not like a betrayal of a specific concrete group of people.
Right.
And that has a different, I think, political effect. And I think one of the effects is to reduce trust in institutions. and to reduce support for constitutionally limited government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on that exact point, it does strike me as interesting the kind of way some people might think that there's a hair being split there, but I don't think so, at least. Like, you know, for instance, those in lowercase l, you know, traditional liberal, classical liberal, however you want to term it, libertarian circles, will list off a bunch of different reasons why certain institutions are either, inefficient or not to be trusted in certain ways. But I don't think it's splitting hair. I think you bring up a good point. It's actually a different reason being given and a different set of logic often given for lowercase l liberals when they talk about, you know, skepticism of certain institutions and power of a certain institution versus what the nationalists are doing.
And one of the distinctions here, I think, is, you know, almost all politics, at least as we think about it in the modern world, deals with a lot of abstractions, right? You know, the nation is an abstraction. It's a group of strangers. Free markets is an abstraction, right?
Right.
It's a system of like economic exchange with certain rules. Private property, freedom of contract, prices being allowed to move, etc. But I think nationalists have an advantage. Whereas when you talk about a nation, you are talking about like a group of people, and it's very easy to conflate that with community. When lowercase l liberals or libertarians, when we talk about individual liberty, when we talk about free markets, when we talk about limited government, when we talk about peace, those are like more abstract than talking about, right, you know, this nation or this core ethnic group. So it is really hard to defend these principles. Whereas I think it's substantially easier for nationalists to try to defend their principles because they can point to a crowd of people and be like, hey, these people are the real nation.
Right.
Whereas you and I, like, well, what I point to, like, what, a system of laws and right, and a free pricing system? Like, what the heck is that?
Right.
I mean, it's real, right? But the process by which prices change in response to relative scarcities, I mean, I'm using like abstractions to explain abstractions.
Right. Yeah.
And that's hard. That's a challenge for us.
Yeah. Well, to describe a system of, to describe a framework that creates unconcentrated, dispersed benefits versus other folks, that I guess the best way to put it, and this ties back to the statist point, I think, and I think your point about state communism, sort of like that Leninism, Stalinism, all that great stuff. I think you're right. There is a parallel there. I think at the end of the day, it's that the state is viewed as a tool to benefit a certain group of people, regardless of what needs to be done, versus a framework for people to essentially live their lives in. I think that's a very important point.
And to go off on that a little bit, you know, communism, I think, is sort of the left-wing, utopian, authoritarian ideology. You know, they don't all fall for it, of course. The vast majority don't. But when they do, they go for that. On the right-wing side, I think, nationalism is the sort of utopian, authoritarian way that some of them fall into.
Mm.
And it leads to similar bad outcomes. I think we're all familiar that communism is the deadliest ideology of the 20th century. Killed the greatest number of people of any ideology. But nationalism is actually a pretty close second when you take a look at that. You take a look at least within countries. If you include things like the World Wars, which were started inspired by right, nationalist politics in multiple different countries, it has a claim for maybe being the top.
Right.
And when you take a look at wars in the 20th century, it's probably the top.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very it's something that we very much need to be aware of and wary of, right? When I talk to acquaintances who are communists, or they say they have affinity for the ideals of communism, you know, they like the, they like the idealism, but they don't like the methods or some kind of nonsense like that, right?
Right.
That you hear people, they say like, oh, what the Soviet Union is not real communism.
Right, right.
Well, when I hear nationalists say like the crimes of nationalists in the 20th century aren't real nationalism, it reminds me of communists saying the same thing.
Yeah.
About their system. And it's like, we don't respect that. When communists say, we say it's ridiculous. So, no, your system is fundamentally flawed.
Right.
What we need to say is when nationalists make excuse for the crimes of nationalists in other countries by saying it's not real nationalism, we need to hold their argument to the same level of contempt that we hold that argument made by communists.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a very important point. And I think you also mentioned in your essay, at least one thinker specifically you quote that does this, but I've seen it from other public intellectuals or those that are proponents of nationalism, that they sort of try to make the distinction that a country that is going to, like, you know, single out another people, invade other folks, you know, be involved in these types of conflict, you know, they might dip into imperialism, but then that's not, quote, real nationalism. It seems to be that's kind of the parallel you're going to. That's the thing that popped into mind too, because I think it'd be very odd to talk about, fascist Italy and fascist Germany in World War II as not real nationalism simply because there was, some conflict and some imperialism going on. I think clearly, yeah. Even in my family history too, being from Italian descendants, I mean, when you get up a few generations, I mean, it's not like they didn't understand that was the context, was nationalism. So,
Yeah, Yoram Hazony is the one who's most guilty of that. I mean, he has a definition in his book, The Virtue of Nationalism, where he says, whenever any nationalist country or whenever a country does something that's bad, it's not nationalist anymore. It's like, well, what a goofy, definition. We would never tolerate that when it comes to communists, right? Imagine a communist saying, when communist countries suffer economic devastation and kill millions of people and starve others to death, that means it's not real communist anymore. It's like, okay, well, that's just like you're changing the definition to say that you're never wrong. And that's obviously the mark of people who are not serious thinkers or who are charlatans or hucksters who are trying to sell an ideology and trying to convince people, knowing full well what the outcome is. We would never tolerate that for others. I don't think we should tolerate it for nationalists. But even more importantly, the way that they define this, the way that Yoram Hazony defines this is like, oh yeah, when Germany tried to conquer other countries or other countries in Europe tried to conquer other countries in Europe, it doesn't count as nationalism. I asked Yoram this. I'm like, okay, well, what about like a European country trying to conquer countries in Africa or Asia, like during the age of imperialism?
Right.
Does that count as nationalism? And he goes, oh, well, it's more complicated. I'm like, well, why? Like, why is that more complicated? Isn't that the same principle? And by that principle, that means there basically weren't any nationalist countries in Europe until like the middle part of the 20th century.
Right.
Because they all had like empires overseas to varying extents. And that's obviously not true because nationalists point back to an age of nationalism in the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 1900s.
Right.
Where like, this is nationalism and this was like pretty good and like, did these really good outcomes. So it's like they try to have it in every way. It's totally unconvincing. It's historically like shockingly ignorant of the past. And it basically tries to prove too much. And basically, if you follow their definition, there really are no nationalist countries in the world, to say nothing of disputes between nationalists, right? Like, so I would say like, you know, the ongoing and endemic conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, right? You have two groups of people,
right,
who think that they have a rightful and legitimate claim to the same piece of territory, and they disagree. And because of that disagreement, they have been fighting for a very long time, and they are fighting now, and they will continue to fight, mm-hmm. I think. And how does that mean that the fighting means that one side is not, that they're not nationalists because they're fighting each other? And there's just, of course not. Yoram Hazony basically says that, and he's Israeli, and he may also be an American, but he's Israeli and writes about it a lot and writes about that conflict. If you follow his argument, at least from some people's perspective, Israel wouldn't count as a nation. Hmm. And that is something that he vehemently disagrees with.
Right.
So it doesn't make any sense, basically.
Yeah.
It's just a bunch of propaganda and it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's historically ignorant and leads to like absurd conclusions if you follow his definition to its logical conclusion.
Right. And following the train of thought and just adding another element, if you will, one thing that I noticed that you guys point out in your essay, and also, like I said, I've noticed this with other nationalist thinkers and public intellectuals and so on, is that that point we were just on about the sort of, oh, once this ideal nationalist states or whatever, if it crosses the line and invades other states or goes imperialist, it's not really a nationalist state. There's all this logic to that too. But this seems to me to at least sidestep and ignore the fact that, okay, well, forget about invading other countries right now. I mean, there's also a history of you know, let's just generalize and say sort of pre-imperialist Nazi Germany before the actual invasion started, where what's happening in those countries is pretty damn horrible. I mean, if you're going to start the whole in-group, out-group thing, I mean, there's not really a lot. I mean, I remember there was one person that said publicly, basically, like, you know, the Hitler thing, yeah, there's some bad things to say about it, but really the problem started when, you know, this person decided to try and take it outside of German borders. Well, I mean, again, there was a lot of stuff happening inside these countries before anybody decided to go imperialist. It seems there's not a lot of answers from that corner when it comes to the nationalists, I should say.
No, it's odd in this sense, where a lot of conservatives, I think, will rightly say that there are values that are universal across countries, right? So we can judge bad things that happen in other cultures, even though they're different cultures, because by our values, they are bad. And I think that's totally legit. I agree with that. But in the same token, they'll say like, well, all these nations are different. We should let nations do their own thing and do whatever they want internally. And who cares? Like, or it's not us to judge because nations have different values. And it's like, that's ridiculous. Like, I can point to nationalist governments committing crimes against citizens of their own government and say, that's wrong. That is wrong, and that is wrong according to universal values, and I agree, and I disagree with that. And nationalists don't really have a leg to stand on to be able to say this. I mean, one of the comments made by, I think it's Aristide Zolberg, who is a historian and social scientist, said that, basically like refugees, like making refugee flows, people to leave your country, is like a nation-building exercise. Because you make people who are not wanted, who are part of minority religions or ethnicities or other groups, basically leave to make the nation more pure and more according to its ideals. Mm-hmm. And that's what countries and governments that are nationalists have tried to do for forever. And this gets to, I guess, a disagreement I have with other people who are actually anti-nationalists like myself, is I think nationalism is something that is innate to humans in almost all cases, and has been the dominant form of political organization throughout human history. I don't think it was invented like around the time of the printing press. I think that's like absurd.
Right.
Like that's just like so ridiculous. I don't even know like where to begin. Like you go back thousands of years, people talked about these different groups and the way that nationalists do today. I mean, it's just like the way that we organize. I think we evolved that way.
Exactly. And indigenous Canadians are actually what certain groups of them, because it splits in many ways. We have Inuit, Métis, but then First Nations as well. I mean, like there's the idea of a nation goes back far beyond anything was happening here with French or English, even. So even Canadians have that sort of lexicon. There was nations of people here before us, right?
Yeah. And that makes sense. And so the point where I agree, though, with anti-nationalists is that we need institutions and rules to reduce this instinct's effect on public policy. We need to channel it in different directions, right? So like I think most people have an instinct to be like religious. You know, to look towards spiritual fulfillment, have that spiritual demand, right? Mm. Not everybody, but most people do. But that doesn't mean that we should have religious government.
Right.
And that means that we should build walls around governing institutions to make sure that religion doesn't have an undue influence on the state and its functions. And I think we can and do that to some extent in successful countries with nationalism, to keep it out of the government as much as possible to limit its impact. It can't be zero. Nothing can be zero, right? If we have it in our natures to do that, but we can reduce its influence to the extent that it allows us to prosper. And that's the way that I view of it. You know, I don't want to take some, I think it's basically akin to saying that we have a conspiracy theory of nationalism, or it's like modern or invented or whatever. It's like a modern psychosis that we can just ignore. We can't do that. But what we can do is acknowledge that it's real in our brains, that it will try to come out at different times, but that we need to be vigilant and build rules and institutions to reduce its impact. Mm.
And I actually think that's an excellent place to take our break, because we're due to do that. So we'll do that right now. Everyone, you're listening to Curious Task. I'm speaking with Alex Narasta today. The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. Feel free to send questions, feedback, guest recommendations, or anything else that's on your mind to curioustask@liberalstudies.ca. As always, a huge thanks to our supporters on Patreon, including Randy T. Simmons, Travis Smith, and John Robson. Remember to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at The Curious Task, rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to The Curious Task, and check out the Institute for Liberal Studies. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to The Curious Task. I'm speaking with Alex Narasta today. Alex, I think the first half was great. We focused a lot on, the context of nationalism, how you understand it. You've also cited some, self-proclaimed nationalist authors and thinkers and so on and so forth. And we started talking about sort of liberal democratic institutions, nationalist potential effect on that. I want to move on in the second half as well to some more economic discussions as well. However, before we get to that, you were just tail-ending a thought there before we went to break about how you think, I guess, it's best for those who are anti-nationalists to see nationalism. I thought that was a very important point because I've observed that too. I've observed that a lot of people that are anti-nationalists, there's a bit of a tone, some of them, not all, of sort of pearl clutching. Some people are out to lunch. Some people are going crazy. Like, what's going on here? And I think that actually puts the anti-nationalists on sort of a back foot if they start from a place where it's like, this is a fundamentally not understandable sort of inhuman thing. Look how these people are behaving. I think that puts a huge gap between someone and the reality and being able to see it. And if they want to dismantle nationalism, frankly, how can they address it if they can't even tap into themselves to understand what's happening? Because I think it's understandable. Not that I would agree. If you piece out some of the grievances that some self-proclaimed nationalists say about whatever, some economic stuff, democratic institutions, I think you need to at least be able to enter the conversation and arrive at similar footing, even if you don't agree, to tackle this beast if you are an anti-nationalist.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I also think the more sort of fundamental issue is a lot of anti-nationalists will just deny that it's an ancient form of political organization, right, that explains the vast majority of states throughout history. And it probably is that way because to an extent, it's part of our evolved psychology and the way that we view. Like, we evolved in small groups of people that are relatively homogeneous, surrounded by other groups that were fairly similar as well. And it is, I think, perfectly understandable in that mindset to have our psychology evolve to the extent where we see outsiders as a threat, and we identify that through how people look, how they sound, other cultural and ethnic or racial characteristics. The difference is we do not need to give in to that naturalistic fallacy. Just because we have, on average, most people, most of the time, those instincts, does not mean that we should give in and say, well, just because we have those instincts, they're good. They're not good. They're destructive. They are unethical. They lead to really bad social and economic outcomes. They may have been good 100,000 years ago when our ancestors lived on the savannah. They are not good anymore. But the way that we get around that is not by denying these factors exist in human nature. I think it's by accepting that, one, they do exist, and then getting very serious and thinking about how we build institutions and rules and norms to reduce their negative impact on our society, to reduce the impact of these destructive instincts that we have, and to channel them in different directions, mm-hmm. to channel them into different types of civil society or organizations that aren't, seeking to control the state, to channel them into groups of like ethnic affinity or to other types of organizations in civil society or into friendship groups. So just channeling it into those directions and to channel it away, frankly, from politics and state power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And on that exact note, the politics and state power part, because you just mentioned there that, just because these instincts or these seeds are there doesn't mean people need to accept them and lean into them and take them to the nth degree, if you will. And in the first half, you said when people take these instincts and run with them, they lead to very absurd and bizarre conclusions. One I wanted to actually ask you about, and you tell me if you share this observation, it's an interesting phenomenon. I kind of call it, you find a lot of people that I call are like sort of hyper individualist nationalists. People on the one hand, on the one side of their mouth, will talk about, anti-government this, get out of my way, I deserve to live my life, etc. But on the other hand, it's not that they just, are, as you said, patriotic about these values. It's they will also not casually, but very actively talk about the will of the nation, you know, this collective group of people that's being impeded upon, needing more state power, etc. I can see how there's some way to square that sort of circle in some ways, but on the whole, not really. We seem to be in this weird cultural time right now where you have like these, as I said, hyper-individualist nationalists. And I think that's one of the, I'm not sure if you agree or if you've observed this as well, but you know, that seems to be a bizarre, absurd conclusion, as you put it in the first half, that I don't think that circle is ultimately squareable, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think what we have there is a phenomenon of a bunch of right-wingers who are pretending to be libertarians or classical liberals, and they're using the language of nationalism to basically own the left. And that's about it. I think these people are sort of using some of the language of libertarianism. They got that from 10 or 15 years ago, and that was more ascendant politically.
Right.
They've globbed onto that and kept it. And then they're also taking the language of the collectivist utopian right, which is nationalism, and basically using both of those to try to bash left-wingers and to try to make left-wingers cry and to drink their tears and whatever it is that right-wingers are really motivated by nowadays. So that is what I think is basically largely explains that. But I think you're right. There is this huge tension. When I hear people who call themselves libertarians or classical liberals and also call themselves nationalists, I think like you just don't know what you're talking about. It would be like somebody saying, I'm classical liberal, but I'm also a hardcore socialist. Like, it's like, well, there's a lot of like problems with that ideology. It basically destroys itself. It doesn't lead to any kind of coherent outcome. And that's what I hear when I hear libertarians or classical liberals also call themselves nationalists. It basically makes as much sense as a modern American libertarian saying that they're a communist.
Right.
Also. They have a lot of these sympathies. It's like, no, you don't. Like, you have to choose because they're fundamentally at odds with each other. Mm-hmm. And there's really no realistic overlap between these things. And I think this is partly because you see, politics at least is like at a disequilibrium in the United States. We have sort of like one growing nationalist right-wing party that uses some of the language of individualism and free markets. That's sort of a holdover from the past. And then you have another party that uses the language of, you know, left-wing collectivism and government control over the economy. But it still kind of tries to pretend like to be internationalist, right? And they're sort of at disequilibrium. They're changing. They're both changing. And as a result of that, you get a lot of conservatives who are just anti-leftists, and they'll just use whatever anti-left-wing language they have. But I really don't think there's much there besides that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I see going on. That's how I explain it. And that's why I just don't take thinkers like that very seriously, because I don't think there's actually much thought there. I think it's just a reflective anti-leftism, which I kind of appreciate because I'm not a leftist. Like, I don't like leftism, but I think the reasons for opposing leftism are basically just rhetorical and not very deep and not very interesting, except as an explanation for why politics is the way it is now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Since you're on that train of thought, I'll continue with it. I want to get to some of the economic specifics in a second, but I want to continue the train of thought you were just on about sort of the current state of the union, if you will, of nationalist sentiment in the United States. That was one of the things I want to ask you about. You were on that train of thought. If you wouldn't mind continuing expanding it, because yeah, to me, I sort of see, and I think you were sort of saying that, but correct me if I'm wrong, that you ultimately have, if you look at the two wings of mainstream sort of political rhetoric and culture right now in the U.S., you ultimately have what seems to be sort of just different flavors of, to some degree, nationalist sort of collectivist type talk. I mean, everyone's talking some degree, if we want to bring the economics in, of industrial policy. I think it's easy to say, and again, correct me if you think differently, that the Democrats are less bad at when it comes to some of the xenophobic stuff. But when you look at policies and the way all that kind of stuff operates, I mean, at the end of the day, to me, it's just sort of different flavors of ice cream of what's being served up, which is collectivist nationalism. But again, I sound like you're on a train of thought, but I wouldn't mind if you expanded on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some distinctions between these two groups, but I think that's broadly correct. Like, the Democrats are not some anti-nationalist party. They're just a slightly different flavor of it. But what I think is interesting is as both parties have gone to embracing nationalism, and the Republican Party has gone much further over the last decade of explicitly embracing nationalism in many fronts, they have also gone much less supportive of free markets.
Yes.
They have also embraced industrial policy, embraced protectionism, embraced nativism, bashing the rich, and trying to embrace labor unions of all things, like in the United States. Something that would have been unthinkable like a decade ago, right, is now like mainstream stuff. You have like senators like Josh Hawley, who is basically like a socialist, but with different flags. You have Marco Rubio going from being a Tea Party free market Republican to now being a national conservative, who supports all different types of industrial policy. These people are basically like Elizabeth Warren, but they hate immigrants, is basically, or dislike immigrants substantially, right? Is basically the modern right wingers. So I don't see that much of a big difference when it comes to economic policy. Now, I know some people who are optimists about this, who are basically tell me like, hey, conservatives in the U.S. are going to use the language of populism and nationalism, but they're really going to push like for better economic policy behind the scenes. And maybe that's true to some extent, but I don't think you could be outwardly a nationalist and a supporter of right-wing collectivism and internally be a libertarian for very long. I think that ultimately one of those things is going to give way, or at least going to substantially compromise with the other one. And I do think that the internal choice of trying to be more free market is going to be the way that compromises. And that is exactly what we've seen in terms of the policy opinions of American conservatives. And you see it on the left as well. You see, basically, you have this arms race between Democrats and Republicans of which party can be the bigger supporter of industrial policy, which party can be the biggest protectionist and cut down on trade, which party can centrally plan the baby formula market the best. Right. And that's about what you see in the United States right now.
Right.
You know, which form of electricity is the government going to support? Like, why should it even do that?
Right.
Is my question.
Exactly. Yeah. And sort of edging our way even further into in that one chunk of your essay there that you and Ilya covered about the economic side of things. I mean, just on a tail end of what you were saying there. I mean, you know, it's interesting before Trump was first elected and when he was first elected, there was sort of that sort of panic and discussion about, you know, this guy talking about, onshoring things, pissing off other countries with certain trade deals and stuff like that. Well, I mean, you fast forward to Joe Biden in office too. I mean, of course, the rhetoric is different, as you said, and there's marginal differences, and certain marginal differences are important, granted. But I mean, I've been reading the last 3-4 years, all this Bidenomics stuff about how, beefing up the industrial base, building more chips here at home, not relying on China or other countries as much. Again, all these topics are nuanced and complex in their own right. But I mean, again, that flavors discussion we were just having, it seems that economic side of it, we're talking about nationalism at the end of the day.
Yeah, if you were to sort of remove a portion of my memory about who was elected in 2016 and 2020 and who was president, and I were just to look at the economic policies carried out during these administration, look at spending, especially trade policy, I couldn't really tell you which party was in power.
Right.
You know, maybe the tax cuts would have given it away, but that, you know, Democrats like tax cuts sometimes too.
Right.
So it probably would have given it away, at least in the first half, but it certainly would not look as if a different party took over in 2021.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent point. Yeah, that's true. I think even the spectrum in the way people talk about things is also so radically blown into different directions. People have a hard time recognizing like an accurate observation, like you just said. I remember when before Obama was elected, I mean, he was supposed to be a communist or socialist, supposedly. You know what I mean? So I think there's all that, now he's, like you said, we speed ahead to today that. Do you think that unfortunately just the game of politics and the battle arena of it, that is the two-party system in the States, has also unfortunately contributed to this idea that, you have to really go cutthroat in terms of painting your opponent as something so anti-nationalist. So now we're having the whiplash and the back effect of it, which is you have two parties that are in different ways, just sort of that nationalist thing again. I mean, for example, I'm sure Joe Biden didn't want to risk being called a socialist like Obama. You know what I mean? So now we're talking again about the industrial base and so on and so forth.
That may have something to do about it. To do with it, I do see a lot of these disagreements in other multi-party democracies. So I'm not really sure it has to do with the specific sort of first past the post Duverger's law system that rules in the U.S. that produces two parties. It may have more to do with countries that have like a presidential system, in that there is like an independently selected head of government who has an enormous amount of power, who represents the whole country and has right. more democratic legitimacy than anybody. Maybe it has something to do with that. Mm-hmm. But I think the baseline level of nationalism has more to do with almost everybody is innately a nationalist to some extent. Mm-hmm. And that can't help but be expressed in some ways through politics. And the weakening of some, classically liberal institutions in a lot of countries has allowed it to various extents to come forth in politics, whereas before it was more constrained, could be some of the explanation. But I'm open to different theories about that. That's just my sort of gut reaction.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting one. I mean, like the office of the president itself is this sort of revered thing, especially since, in our modern context, this whole post-World War II leader of the free world type narrative, right?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, just again, we can't prove this today just casually talking, but as soon as you said that, it sort of made me think maybe unfortunately, it might have been sort of as the executive power built after World War II and so on and so forth, and this position was looked at as such. I wonder if, unfortunately, it's sort of created a bit of a magnetic or gravitational pull for this strongman type style politics, right? I mean, if you look at the way, for example, I mean, regardless of their actual policies, regardless of overthrowing regimes and so on and so forth, I don't want to get into that now, especially some listeners are very astute with that stuff. But, you look at the way, for instance, someone like Eisenhower spoke, that was still very much lowercase r republic type of presidential speak. And now we're up to the point where every president or person that wants to be elected is basically saying, I'm the strong man or woman that you want in this position to do all these great things for the nation.
Yeah, so I don't think it can explain it fully. This presidential system or concentration of executive power leading to nationalism, it's endogenous, to use a term of economics, right? The presidential system affects nationalism. Nationalism affects the presidential system. And it's sort of maybe in the cycle itself reinforcing. It's just presidential systems where you have like a single independently elected head of state that has a substantial amount of power seem a little more, they might be a little more susceptible to this. Not always, not everywhere, but it seems to be more susceptible. And I would say countries that have for serious foreign policy disagreements with other countries of that neighbor them or that are of similar strength militarily might also explain part of it.
Right.
So like, maybe the rise of China coincident with the United States, that could have an impact on that. Israel with Palestinians, Russia, Ukraine. I don't know, maybe some of this stuff that has some kind of explanation as well. There definitely is like a foreign policy angle, but I don't think any of these things can explain it fully. Mm-hmm. And I do think like the ultimate overall baseline is like most people are nationalists most of the time. And some of these institutions have weakened, and maybe they've weakened for bad institutional reasons, like their institutions are breaking a little bit. And that allows an opening for nationalists to come in. So that, I think, is probably the big thing. But what explains that breakage? I don't know. There's a lot of guesses out there and just so stories. And my background's in empirical economics, so I don't really take a lot of those stories seriously, especially since so many are so ideologically convenient for people who right. push them, and because I want to see them tested.
Right. Right. And I'm just looking at the clock here. We're heading to the last swing of our time here. So just a couple more questions and we'll wrap up. But based on that empirical economics part, I mean, of course, it would be silly of me to let you go if we didn't talk about immigration just a little bit. So I think I left it on purpose. One of the last bad things you talked about in real world nationalism is xenophobia. So, I mean, I don't mean to be so curt about this or sort of pithy, but I mean, it's true. I mean, at the end of the day, and actually you've spoken with him on a news show before, someone like a Tucker Carlson right now is currently running around trying to explain to people how, not the only thing he's claiming, but one of the great things about Russia is look how great these people care about each other. And it's really that nationalist type of feel he's over there. A lot of nationalists want to, what I'm trying to get at is look at how that nationalism fuels a sense of that us and them, really regulates sort of immigration flows, who can get in, so on and so forth, as one of the main pillars of what makes a successful nationalist country. You spent a lot of time, basically for lack of a better term, showing people how that's a lot of crap. So I wouldn't mind if you just sort of take that point however you'd wish, but that xenophobic point and this immigration point, nationalists are so stuck on it that if they can just maintain control of the border and the flow of people, they could get rid of all the negative effects. So, you know, over to you. I mean, like, have there been that many negative effects, number one, of immigration? And number two, does that really look like a solution that the nationalists can actually pursue to some success, or are they just fooling themselves?
Nationalists are fooling themselves. They think that a lot of problems caused in modern countries are by too many immigrants and too many foreigners. The fact of the matter is, if there weren't any immigrants or foreigners, they would pick on a domestic group and blame all the country's problems on them. So it's just blame shifting. You can never blame the nationalists. They'll never blame themselves, and I understand why. You know, who wants to blame themselves for problems or their ideology? They'll never blame the nation for any kind of problems. And, you know, hard policy questions like bad economic policy or whatever, that's not sexy enough for them to pursue electorally. It's too complicated for nationalists to really understand. So as a result, this is just their pursuit. And the evidence that immigration causes serious problems is very underwhelming. There are some places and some times where there are more problems, of course, than in other places. And I think the issues caused by immigration in the United States, for instance, are different than they are in Canada. And Canada and the U.S. are more similar than the issues are in a country like France, mm-hmm. Where bad immigration policy has caused a lot of problems over the years. And bad economic policy over there has caused a lot of problems. Bad labor market policy that makes it difficult for people to integrate, but also selects a specific kind of migrant who are perhaps more interested in living in government housing on welfare than working. Whereas in Canada and the United States, there are some limitations on that. So it really does attract sort of the upwardly mobile immigrant who wants to come to a new place and work. So you just have a lot of these feedback mechanisms that are really bad that don't have much to do with, you know, treason or bad people or, you know, betraying the essence of the nation or whatever. Just like normal, mundane, bad policies that lead to other bad results. And whoops, let's blame a bunch of foreigners for all of our issues. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to blame foreigners than it is to blame your own country, because foreigners can't vote in your elections.
Right. Right. And is it fair to summarize? Cause I've seen on Twitter, especially, or X, or whatever the heck you want to call it, you know, people seem to have this misconception about your work in this area. And I've spoken to you about it before a couple years ago. I've read your stuff and so on and so forth. So I just want to kind of ask about it now, kind of thing, to be 100% clear, because people seem to still miss this. You were just on that train of thought. It's not that you think that there can't be bad immigration policy that creates bad outcomes for immigrants and the people in the country. It's just that, you know, again, correct me if I'm wrong, to summarize, you think that that's what it comes down to, the policies of the actual state, and it's the state's problem, not the fact that people want to go somewhere.
That's right. It's the policy. It's the problems with policies. So not every country should probably have the immigration policy that I want the United States to have. It's just that I know U.S. policy and the effects in this country a lot better than others. But I do think that every country should be more open, but maybe more open in different ways. So, for instance, like France really hasn't had like an economic immigration policy in decades. It's basically like family reunification plus asylum.
Right.
And open to the EU. And I think what they should have is a policy that makes it reduces labor market rules so people can work immediately, reduce welfare for migrants so that they have to work immediately, and creating more of a system that allows large numbers of temporary workers and economic migrants from around the world to come to France to be able to work, combined with a family system that's fairly open and generous.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's different than the U.S., where I think we should liberalize it for everybody,
right
across the board.
Fair enough.
Because yeah. we have different things, different issues here.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Thank you for that answer. Okay, so our time has definitely wound down there. Do you think, last question, then I'm going to wrap this up. Some hosts do this. I'm not actually looking for the positive, optimistic end note. It's really just, if you feel it's positive, great. If it's cynical, let's hear it. But does the future look more nationalist or less in your mind based on current trends? I'm not going to talk the world. Let's talk about the United States context, right? From what you're seeing now, both politically, economically, You know, where does this ride take us with this movement that, you know, 20 years ago, we might have said there was a few people in a lecture hall angry about this stuff during the Bush years, right? Now we're talking about this could be a tour de force on the national stage. Is this a flash in the pan thing, or are we on this ride for a bit?
I think we're on this ride for a little bit, but not forever. And the reason why we're not on this ride forever is because nationalism produces terrible outcomes and fails. So I'm a short to medium run pessimist, long-term optimist, right? But how optimistic should you be if I told you, like, in 1917 Russia that, hey, communism doesn't work, so in the long run, it's going to revert back to something else, right? Like, okay, well, great. We've got, like, you know, 75 years of crap to go through before we get to something else that's a little bit less bad. So a lot of damage can be done in a short period of time. But as Adam Smith said, there's also a lot of ruin in a nation.
Right.
So long run optimist.
Fair enough. All right. So, Alex, let's formally wrap this up. We've talked about a lot. I'd like to bring the conversation full circle, put a finer point on our exploration of the question. In each episode, I want to make sure the guest has the last word. So let me ask you the final official question. What do you ultimately hope are the main takeaways for someone listening to you here on what's wrong with nationalism? In other words, we've talked about a lot. If you want someone to take away just one, two, or a few things, if anything, from everything we've talked about and you've said, what would you want them to take away?
Nationalism is the right-wing communism, a utopian, authoritarian ideology that leads to horrible outcomes. So oppose it. That would be my one sentence elevator pitch for the median voter.
I think we'll leave it there. So Alex Narasta, thank you very much for joining me in the Curious Task again.
Thanks for having me.
The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. This episode was produced by Alex Aragona, Sabine Elchidiak, and Eric Seguin. Our executive producer is Matt Bufton. The music you hear on the podcast is by Lindy Voppenfjord. You should check out his other stuff online. The Curious Task exists today because of donations of time and money from those creating it and listeners like yourself. Check us out on Patreon and find out how you can support us and get access to exclusive offers. I'm Alex Aragona, and thank you very much for joining us on The Curious Task. We'll be right back.